Thank you for downloading this Finnish Institute of International Affairs recording. You can find more recordings at www.fiia.fi.
Well, it's a pleasure to be making my debut here as a visiting senior fellow at FIIA. As Bob mentioned, I've spent a lot of my professional life, actually I just retired from the U.S. Department of Defense in June of 2015, after spending about, I guess, a total of 30 years combined between the Pentagon and National Defense University, and served in one of the intelligence agencies before then. So it's been a long government career. But this is a very unique opportunity that I look forward to, not only to share some of my own experience, but basically really to learn from Finland. And for many of you in the audience and my colleagues at FIIA and others, about how you see this, not only your own country, but this region and relations with the U.S. I'd like to focus my remarks a little bit more on transatlantic defense and security issues, and looking for inspiration for the theme of these remarks. I actually recalled some opening lines from the Charles Dickens masterpiece, Tale of Two Cities, when he wrote in the very opening lines, he said, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was an age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity." And for me, these words actually capture the state of transatlantic defense and security relations here in the summer of 2016. At the NATO Warsaw Summit that was held at the beginning of last month, the way I would assess it is that it had much exceeded the expectations of many defense and foreign policy experts, both within governments and among the allies, and partners, and within the general public. But as you remember, just a couple weeks before then, it was preceded by the UK's Brexit referendum on June 23rd. And within days after the summit, the attention of Europeans and Americans alike shifted to the horrific July 14 attacks in Nice, which were ISIS-inspired. And one day later, the bloody but ultimately failed coup attempt in Turkey. In short, we are witnessing a very complex phenomenon where the transformation and renewal within NATO will have to coexist with serious and sometimes violent challenges to the political and social order within a number of its member states. So let me begin first with the positive news from the Warsaw Summit. In my view, the 28 heads of government and heads of state managed to balance NATO's highest priority, which remains strengthening deterrence and collective defense, with the need that NATO has recognized really since the beginning of the 1990s to respond to conflicts beyond its borders, and more recently, in particular, to the terrorist threats that emanate from those conflicts. Let me give you just four examples. Faced with Russia's continued annexation of Crimea, its destabilizing military presence and support to separatists in eastern Ukraine, which is manifest despite denials from Moscow, and the provocative large-scale military exercises and other activities that it's carrying on, such as the harassment of Allied ships and aircraft in the international waters and international airspace, NATO has agreed on several measures that go beyond its commitments at the September 2014 Wales Summit. Beginning early next year, you will see four battalion-sized multinational battle groups. These are headed by the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, and Canada, and they will be deployed in the three Baltic states and in Poland. This will guarantee, in my view, that any Russian aggression toward one or more of those allies will quickly meet a collective response. And as the NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg has pointed out, the forward presence decision it's a groundbreaking one for NATO, especially since, and I'm quoting the Secretary General now, it's an open-ended commitment and will last as long as necessary. NATO's plan for a tailored forward presence in the Black Sea region is less impressive, but it is laying the groundwork for a possible strengthening of NATO air and maritime presence in that region, which is a complicated task given Russia's improved anti-access and aerial denial capabilities that are now based and being strengthened in Crimea and over the past year in western Syria. Meanwhile, in response to multiple instances of nuclear saber rattling by President Putin and other senior Russian officials, the Allies put Russia on notice that, and I'm quoting here from the NATO declaration, from the summit declaration, quote, any employment of nuclear weapons against NATO would fundamentally alter the nature of the conflict. The circumstances in which NATO might have to use nuclear weapons are extremely remote. But here comes an important sentence. If the fundamental security of any of its members were to be threatened, NATO has the capabilities and resolve to impose costs on an adversary that would be unacceptable and far outweigh the benefits that an adversary could hope to achieve. I welcome this clear language. At the same time, the alliance was careful not to ignore its strategic interests in the arc of insecurity and instability that stretch now from Afghanistan through the broader Middle East into northern Africa. Steve has mentioned President Obama's decision to increase the ceiling of U.S. presence, soldiers present in Afghanistan until the end of his administration. But I think it's important to note that as a result, NATO and its operational partners, such as Georgia, Australia, but also including Finland and Sweden, have committed as an alliance and as partners to maintain some 11,000 military personnel in the Resolute Support mission beyond 2016. And I would just note historically that Americans have underappreciated the role that Europeans have played in Afghanistan. You know, it, as of 2009, 2010, that's several years back, but there were six NATO allies that actually had lost more men and some women killed in combat in Afghanistan per capita than the United States, something that most Americans simply don't appreciate. At Warsaw, NATO also agreed for the first time to deploy its airborne warning and control aircraft and multinational crews over Allied territory, and here, of course, we're speaking primarily Turkey, but also international waters, to support the U.S.-led anti-ISIS coalition. Among the summit's other accomplishments was to give new impetus and new substance to the NATO-EU strategic partnership. I worked a lot on the beginnings, the rough beginnings of the NATO-EU relationship when I was still in the Pentagon and the director of NATO policy at the beginning of the 2000s. And I have to say that despite a formal declaration of this strategic partnership in 2002, the partnership between NATO and the EU, it's gotten better, but it has failed to reach its full potential. So I'm happy to see that there was a separate statement at Warsaw where Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, the EU, the European Council President, Donald Tusk, and the EU Commission President, Jean-Claude Juncker, cited seven specific areas of new or intensified cooperation relevant to common security challenges in the East. These are the so-called hybrid threats and cyber defense, and the South, the challenges being led by migration, terrorism, and security capability building. And here is an aside, I would say that as a member of the EU and as a close partner of NATO and a nation that takes seriously the concept of a comprehensive approach to security and to civil-military cooperation, I think that Finland can be a major contributor to the intensification of NATO and EU cooperation. You have skills, you have ideas, you have experience that I think will be welcomed by both organizations, even though for now you're only a member of one. Now, in the interest of time, I'm not going to say much about the very long subject of NATO capabilities, but I do want to make two points. There are encouraging signs that several allied governments are stopping or reversing the excessive reductions in defense spending that have plagued many European militaries over the past two decades. More needs to be done, and I agree with the previous speakers that the next U.S. administration and new Congress, whether it's Democratic-controlled or Republican-controlled, will press our European and Canadian allies to do more in this regard. But I do also want to give credit where credit is due. There are real, albeit modest, increases in European defense spending that are taking place today. Second, multinational cooperation on defense capabilities is improving, albeit selectively. Finland has a lot of experience in this area, more and more, thankfully, thanks to Nordefco, also thanks to its bilateral cooperation with the United States. But I want to bring to your attention another interesting and very, very important example. In late July, the Dutch Defense Ministry announced the purchase, in cooperation with Luxembourg, of two Airbus multi-role tanker transport aircraft. Now, in Pentagon jargon or in defense jargon, these are called MRTTs. These MRTT aircraft will be NATO property. They're going to be stationed at Eindhoven Air Base, and they're going to be available for pooling and sharing, including with the European Union. Belgium, Germany, Norway, and Poland have said they intend to join this agreement at a later date, and this could lead to the purchase of an additional six aircraft. This is an important contribution to the scarce tanker and transport capability of the European Union in particular, since in addition to refueling aircraft and strategic transports, these MRTTs can also be used for carrying personnel and performing medical evacuations. If necessary, they can carry complete intensive care units. I want to note as well that these are European aircraft, which demonstrates, and I would say here once again demonstrates, that this push to improve NATO and EU capabilities is not just a quote-unquote buy American campaign. So while there's this good news, there's some good news about NATO, I would say that we cannot ignore the fact that new forces and actors outside NATO's political military purview are posing real and in some cases growing risks for NATO's ability over time to develop or to deliver, I should say, on its agenda. And I want to here draw examples from several countries. Notwithstanding the reassuring tone of Prime Minister May and other senior British officials in the new Conservative government, the Brexit decision, assuming it will be executed over the next 2 years or so, could impact the alliance, and in several ways. An extended UK economic slowdown or recession as a result of the uncertainty surrounding Brexit would make it harder for the May government to keep its promise to spend at least 2% of its GDP on defense. Already, the stiff pressures on the pound are going to make it, over time, if these continue, more expensive to purchase equipment, not only from Europe, but from the United States. The May government has now received Parliament's approval to renew the UK nuclear deterrent with a fleet of four new successor, they're called ballistic missile submarines. Once again, in the jargon, these are SSBNs. But Brexit has increased the risks of what for me would be a nightmare scenario. Specifically, the staunchly pro-EU Scottish Nationalist Party might call a second referendum on independence for Scotland, which they would be better positioned, I think, to win than their failed attempt in September of 2014. Now, if they do win, the Nationalists have promised to terminate an agreement dating from the 1960s to base those UK SSBNs and the nuclear weapons that they carry on the west coast of Scotland. And this is an outcome that many fear would spell the end of the UK's independent nuclear deterrent. Now, in the United States, Steve and Mike have already mentioned the wild card of an entirely different nature in the form of the Republican candidate, Donald Trump. I won't say much except to say, frankly, that in my view, he appears to live in a fact-free environment when it comes to NATO. In Europe, further political and societal evils, upheavals can't be ruled out either. And let me just list them very quickly. In France, President Hollande, a socialist, has actually overseen a very positive French engagement with the NATO and markedly improved bilateral military and intelligence relationship with the US. But his election next May is far from certain, and several of his leading challengers have taken some problematic stances regarding NATO and with regard to a certain tolerance for Russian aggression against Ukraine. Germany is not immune from threats. You have all seen that while the German Chancellor played a key role in extending EU sanctions against Russia earlier this summer, her decision to have Germany lead one of the framework battalions, theirs is in Lithuania, has been implicitly criticized by her coalition partner and foreign minister, Mr. Steinmeier. Her policy on refugees has been under internal criticism from her own conservative partners, not to mention the SPD. We see growing strength of the Alternative for Germany right-wing party there. Finally, let me just mention that the situation in Turkey poses a number of challenges involving the U.S. and the anti-ISIS operations, and the sustainability of the agreement between the EU and Turkey to reduce the refugee and migrant flow to Europe. In case you haven't noticed, on Monday, Turkey's foreign minister told a German parliamentary delegation that wanted to visit German Air Force units at the Incirlik Air Base that they couldn't go there unless the Merkel government distanced itself from the Bundestag's statement terming the deaths in Armenia in 1915 as a quote-unquote genocide. None of this is to say, my concluding remark is, none of this is to say is that all of these worst-case scenarios will come to pass. As a longtime participant and observer in NATO affairs, I can say that the alliance and the broader transatlantic bonds and the democratic values below them, they have proved more resilient than adversaries and detractors have predicted. But given the cross current of these multiple, diverse, and unpredictable challenges facing the alliance that I've just quickly mentioned, it's perhaps not surprising that the celebratory atmosphere following the Warsaw Summit was remarkably brief. So thank you very much.